This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
As we walked through a reforested area of Pedro Pablo Motumbahoy's farm in March 2015, we stopped to admire a pair of mint green butterflies that were almost camouflaged against a patch of lichen inhabiting the bark of a nearby tree. Pedro Pablo remarked that these butterflies never appeared during the almost 15 years when his family dedicated the surrounding 14 hectares of land to growing monoculture coca. His family was not unlike many others that settled in the rural municipality of Puerto Guzmán, Putumayo, since the late 1950s, when they found themselves obliged to migrate or were forcibly displaced to the Andean Amazonian foothills due to political violence, economic precarity and land concentration in the agriculture interior of the country. I began fieldwork in the Andean Amazonian foothills of Colombia in 2004, at the height of renewed critiques of the U.S.-Colombia anti-drug policy, Plan Colombia. In the year 2000, when Plan Colombia commenced, the southwestern frontier state of Putumayo produced over 40% of the country's illicit coca cultivations. The region quickly converted into the epicenter of aerial fumigation and forced manual eradication interventions, as well as intensified military surges when hemispheric counter-narcotic and counterinsurgency efforts were conflated post-9/11. At the time, Colombia's national government and the largest and longest-standing leftist guerrilla organization in the Western Hemisphere, the FARC-EP, were engaged in an over 50-year social and armed conflict. One of the central components of anti-drug strategies consisted in crop duster planes spraying a formula of Monsanto's herbicide glyphosate over suspected illicit coca, marijuana, and opium poppy crops, without distinguishing between plantation and small landholding size cultivations. The mixture of glyphosate utilized is estimated to have been 110% more concentrated than Monsanto's commercially available weed-killing version Roundup Ultra. The volatile nature of aerial aspersion as a chemical application method caused forests, soils, pastures, livestock, watersheds, subsistence food, and human bodies to be regularly misted with the formula of glyphosate. And this controversial policy went on from 1994 to 2015, when a national resolution was finally passed to suspend aerial aspersion with glyphosate after the World Health Organization's cancer research arm reclassified the world's most widely used herbicide under the category 2A, or a probable carcinogen, to humans. Counter-narcotic strategies in Colombia have employed chemical warfare tactics since the late 1970s, and glyphosate is only the last in a series of chemical agents utilized. So I had not been invited to Pedro Pablo's farm that morning to simply rejoice in its ecological resilience. Rather, I had been invited to witness the way the emergent reforestation project was violently interrupted. In 2006, after their coca, subsistence crops, and farm animals were airily fumigated three times, Pedro's family decided to uproot their coca plants. They let much of the farm sit still to be reclaimed by Rastrojo, initial regrowth forest. And after 5 years, they began to plant native timber-yielding varieties among the naturally regenerating trees. Pedro Pablo took the presence of the butterflies to indicate that some kind of enmienda, remedy, or setting right was taking place. A gradual recuperation of diverse vegetation, soils, insects, watershed area, and he hoped one day the family's economy. However, a fourth round of aerial fumigation hit Pedro Pablo's now cocalist farm in 2013, killing approximately 350, or a quarter hectare of cultivated trees, among other flora and, of course, forest inhabitants, such as the butterflies we witnessed that morning. The fumigated trees remain leafless. Their white branches splayed out like bony fingers, skeletons of trees entangled with the living vegetation that had not been misted by an indeterminate herbicidal agent. Pedro Pablo told me that he left the trees standing as evidence, toxic imprints in the ecology, the traces of what was, is becoming forest. When I later returned to the images of these skeletal remains of trees, I was reminded of what I came to think of as a kind of evidentiary ecology produced by a similar wood. In 2007, while visiting farms further south, I observed a large wooden cross standing solemnly beneath the glaring brightness of the equatorial sun. The cross was erected in the middle of an overgrown field to mark the presence of a mass grave that could not be disclosed to local authorities, given the ongoing nature of war and state complicity in right-wing paramilitary violence. Both the cross and the defoliated remains of trees harbor a public secret that decompositionally persists in the landscape, a festering wound of ongoing impunity and irreparable loss. By evidentiary ecologies, I refer to an alternative form of making and registering evidence when it is impossible to meet the structurally asymmetric demands of state-based knowledge production, and when faced with the limits to the science of toxicology and its application in complex environments that may also be under military duress. I recount this story about the skeletal remains of trees and the reappearance of butterflies because it speaks to the way environmental restoration and attention to climate adaptability may contribute to the transformation of territorial conflicts and peace-building efforts in historically militarized zones. Thinking in the presence of glyphosate-exposed landscapes offers one response to Anna Singh's call for us to create a vocabulary for livable disturbance. That is to consider how varied trajectories of disturbance are made ecologically viable for some, but never all forms of life. As Singh explains it, this is not meant to justify environmental destruction, nor, I add, to transcend the impossibility of achieving reparative justice. Indeed, it might provide a first step in coming to terms with the unevenly distributed condition of having to not only carry on with, but also processly transform chemically degraded life. In the current political conjuncture in Colombia, the categories and material practices constituting what we may call nature and science are occupying shifting and crucial roles in times of conflict and transition. A peace agreement was signed in December 2016 between the national government and the FARC-EP, and the second largest guerrilla group in the country, the National Liberation Army, is still negotiating a peace process. Across different national contexts, issues of war crimes and violence have primarily focused on humans as victims and actors, within legal frameworks concerned with the defense and violation of human rights and international humanitarian law. Recently in Colombia, there's been emergent public debate over the way soils, rivers, forests, among other living beings and quote-unquote natural resources, are also casualties and scenes of war, requiring reparative treatment in the country's ongoing post-conflict, what others call post-accord, and transitional justice process. Given the glaring absence of environmental issues in the peace accords, diverse popular coalitions have proposed constituting an environmental truth commission to reconstruct the environmental memory of diverse socio-ecological conflicts and to work towards the integral reparation of human, non-human continuums of life, what they call making peace with and from the territories. At the same time, many scientists argue that no baseline environmental knowledge exists for much of the country due to the fact that territories were impenetrable and thus unoccupied by the state and unexplored by scientists due to the historical presence of armed groups. Scientists express excitement about the opportunities for expanding predictive horizons, risk mitigation, conservation mechanisms, and general knowledge of the country's biodiversity. Simultaneously, there is growing public concern over the fact that territories previously impenetrable and hence largely conserved during times of war will now be open to development and the environmental destruction wrought by intensified extractivism. These concerns are palpable in statistics registering a 44% rise in deforestation after the demobilization of the FARC, which caused something akin to a power vacuum, allowing illegal mining and logging and extensive cattle ranching to expand in newly opened up territories. The state's response has been to create an interinstitutional working group referred to as burbujas ambientales, or environmental bubbles, that rely on military and police to control deforestation and illegal mining. This raises questions about the perpetuation of violence and criminalization that emerges when environmental protection measures change hands from paralegal armed actors to state, police, and military forces. Community proposals to reconstruct the environmental memory of territories that have been epicenters of war situates violence not only within the context of armed dispute and militarization. These proposals also focus on the degradation and dispossession that has been realized through the transfer of land and other resources to multinational corporate actors and complex configurations of criminal, new money, and traditional landowning classes for the development of mega-infrastructural, mining energy, and agro-industrial projects. Along with dispossession, which, as Robert Nichols argues, presupposes existing property relations that may never have existed, or were established through originary seizures or thefts of land that require a long-durée reconstruction of layered histories of violence. It is the rupture and aspirational repair of socio-ecological relations that is also at stake. These socio-ecological ruptures include local communities that no longer fish in rivers, where victims' mutilated bodies were disposed, or bathe and drink from rivers that are now turbid due to contamination from illegal mining. The socio-natural disasters that result when water can no longer be absorbed by soil in floodplain areas where rivers were diverted after populations displaced by war-provoked urban growth. The chemical inheritance of glyphosate-exposed landscapes among former coca-growing communities, and the myriad of everyday practices that were prohibited by armed actors, and the knowledges that have been marginalized by the modernizing logics that inform state-based agricultural extension and international aid policy. When writing on the layered histories of war in parts of the Middle East, Omar Diwachi refers to wounds as constituting the interstitial tissue of the social. They are what bring people together and what sets them apart. Yet wounds are not only embedded within a human-focused sociality. They are constitutive of ruptured socio-ecological relations and are imprinted in a myriad of bodies, including the bodies of soils, water, and rocks, and the mosaic landscapes from which they evolve and also form a part. More than simply broadening medicalized level discourses of trauma and institutional categories of victimhood to include what we may call nature or natural resources, I am compelled to stay with the trouble of relations, borrowing a phrase from Donna Haraway, to explore the speculative possibilities of the reconstruction of environmental memory. I am interested in how this kind of memory work in formerly militarized ecologies may complicate rights of nature discourses and a reliance on the attainment of legal personhood for certain species or rivers, for example, that has been celebrated among Latin American constitutional reforms in such countries as Ecuador, Bolivia, and beyond. The reconstruction of environmental, or what some social movements call biocultural memory, poses speculative questions around the treatment of temporality and scale, the guarantees of non-repetition, and the aspirational quality of more than human actualizations of justice. In one conversation I had with an economist working as a consultant for Colombia's special peace tribunals, we discussed the difficulties of establishing legal mechanisms that would sentence demobilized combatants to pay their crimes as environmental sentences. This would entail that demobilized FARC live among the human and non-human communities they directly affected, and work to repair these degraded territories. This economist mentioned the obstacles that he confronted when attempting to measure and calculate damages and then correlate these values with punitive, yet conciliatory sentencing mechanisms. How was one to measure the extent of damage caused by oil spills when the FARC recurrently blew up pipelines? How to reconcile the punctual time of a detonated bomb that fractures infrastructure with the half-life of crude oil released into soils and watersheds with the time, i.e. criminal sentence, that should be served by the human perpetrators of such acts? These questions were further complicated when we discussed the methodological and ethical difficulties of separating out crimes and isolating accountability to the FARC, especially when much of the violence experienced by rural communities has not only or even primarily been a result of armed conflict, but the way war created the conditions for the expansion of a new extractive national development model and the implementation of mega-infrastructural projects. How would the guarantees of non-repetition of violations of rights be ensured when the state's development model remains the same? How can memories of violence be reconstructed when socio-environmental conflicts result from demobilization and hence continue in official times of peace? In her work on the petrochemical history of the St. Clair River, Michelle Murphy introduced the temporal concept of latency to think about how the submerged chemicals of the past become reactivated in the present to disrupt the reproduction of the latter. Through latency, she writes, the future is already altered. Similarly, rural communities articulate their experiences of aerial spraying of glyphosate in its brute immediacy and complex reverberating series of toxic effects. What are the times of post-glyphosate? The crop-dusted past may manifest itself in the present through absence, in the abandoned farmhouses of families that could no longer withstand repeated aerial assaults against their livelihoods, or in pastures emptied of animals after their lethal poisoning. It may persist in the intricate biochemical matrices of soil when they regain a minimal semblance of their former health, or irreversibly alter life in intergenerational time, after debts are accrued when the harvests that were intended to provide a family's economic sustenance were abruptly destroyed by spray drift. Chemically altered life harbors the memories and material residues of harm wrought against it within the same wounds from which reparative acts may also germinate. When Pedro Pablo stands beside two tara trees that he planted on the same day to demonstrate the stunted growth of the one hit by glyphosate spray drift, he retains this dead seedling for its ability to hold the geopolitically backed violence of state law and corporate complicity accountable. Yet it does not only do this. His family's tentative recovery of forests composed of the skeletal remains of trees and the reappearance of butterflies actualizes a form of justice that does not defer it to a future moment determined by intermediaries of the state. Instead, the chemical-based degradations of the past, which are inevitably present in the ecological relations of the present and future forests, are reworked through everyday reparative acts that acknowledge one's participation in deforestation, and by creating both subtle and conspicuous landscape markers to signal and remember violently extinguished life. When I attended a regional forum last September on the reconstruction of environmental memory in the city of Bucaramanga, Santander, I listened to community proposals for how to narrate memory beyond the written text and its racialized and colonial ties to a lettered city and national historical archive. Who would speak for nature? More specifically, how would the recovery of environmental memory complement yet differentiate from histories of environmental struggle that remain centered on the conflicts over distribution of resources in natural spaces between humans? What is the memory of a watershed or the affluence of a river? When engaging with these questions, a women's association that is part of the social movement for the defense of the Chucurí and Sogamoso rivers, Rios Vivos Santander, embroidered the memory of these rivers and their disappearance onto burlap sacks. They engaged in a popular diagnostic of the flora, fauna, and microclimates that had existed and wove a social cartography situating the arrival of narco-trafficking and the transit of different armed actors. They reconstructed the local technologies that had been used for fishing and that had been intimately tied to popular ancestral practices that were no longer possible after the construction of a hydroelectric dam and the inundation of local communities and agricultural lands. What emerged was a participatory exercise to track what war, vis-a-vis mega-infrastructural projects, had done to rivers and what role the rivers had played in war. One woman told me, "The rivers are guiding thread, not only to document past socio-ecological harm, but to imagine how to identify with, recover, and inhabit a given territory, to listen and narrate the past and present differently." During the forum, emphasis was placed on not only the way social movements became the researchers and protagonists reconstructing environmental memory, but also the memories that rivers, as natural bodies and relational entities, both harbor and are able to articulate. I was left wondering what collaborative role the life sciences might assume in this kind of collective memory exercise, and particularly how establishing post-conflict scientific environmental baselines might both differ from and or enter into dialogue with popular practices of remembering the life and health of a particular watershed. One example is the Alexander von Humboldt's Biological Resource Institute's launching of the Colombian Bio-Expedition, a 21st century botanical expedition that aims to update the country's inventory of species and genetic information by conducting research in rural war-torn territories previously unoccupied by the state. In my conversations with geologists and hydrologists, they acknowledge their limited knowledge of the fluvial systems of the country and argue that they need to reconsider everything from their data on geomorphological conditions to their cloud and precipitation measurements given the current political conjuncture. The treatment of epistemological indeterminacy and uncertainty during war and official times of peace is bound up in the ontological status of rocks, soils, and clouds, and what can be known about the behavior and past lives of rivers, especially in the complex and conspicuously biodiverse transition zones between Andean foothills and Amazonian plains. I've begun a new research project that places processes to reconstruct environmental memory in conversation with the situation where post-conflict and transitional justice scenarios come to overlap with socio-natural disaster. On April 1st, 2017, a flash flood involving several rivers and ravines destroyed 60% of the Andean Amazonian city of Mocoa, the capital city of Putumayo, dragging massive amounts of sediment down from the Andean foothills. People displaced to the city over the last 20 years by the country's social and armed conflict occupied most of the 17 neighborhoods that had been constructed in a historical floodplain and that were destroyed. The project addresses a series of speculative questions about the kinds of environmental standards that may emerge in efforts to integrate a river's right to expand, pulsate, and return to its previous course. How does the rebuilding of a city that inhabits the territories of rivers, whose pulsating space-time continuums are acknowledged, become imagined and enacted? This is a photo of a painting by Eduardo Quinchoa, a member of the Inga community Mocoa, which expresses one post-disaster imagining of the Mocoa River watershed that has become the banner for a recently formed citizen-led environmental observatory accompanying the city's reconstruction. My preliminary sense is that the integration of proposals evoking the right of water to be absorbed by soil and of rivers to pulsate and expand, with the environmental memory reconstructed by communities displaced to floodplain zones due to social and armed conflict, will complicate liberal rights-based structures requiring the achievement of legal personhood for the protection of nature, the subjectivity. In addition, citizen-led environmental observatories may become an alternative forum for local peace-building efforts and the creation of emerging environmental publics in times of ongoing conflict and transition. Popular practices of remembering ruptured socio-ecological relations and assembling what I've called evidentiary ecologies that hold specific actors accountable within the wounds from which reparative acts also germinate may not only trouble our understandings about temporalities of violence, but also invite us to pay attention to the material stakes of more than human actualizations of justice.